have a clause 4, and they called it in their constitution, which called for the public ownership of a means of production, basically, I'm paraphrasing, but that's what it called for in British society. You know, if they had fought for that, that would have become a revolutionary struggle. And of course, they did. The British Labour Party did bring in, universal health service, which has been under attack ever since and is still under attack now, but it's much, much better than healthcare in the United States, obviously. Democrats are not putting forward universal health service. Some of them are talking single payer off and on, slowly, slowly, slowly. And what they mean by that is really debatable. And that's very relevant to the $15 minimum wage thing, which we'll get into. The way the Democrats are approaching that, it seems like more and more of them are catching on to it, but in a way that actually hurts people in some ways in terms of, 15, but with all these qualifiers. And when is always iffy. I think they wait for elections or wait for the pressure to build before they decide to move at all on that. Anyway, it is noon. It is 12 noon, and we have to give our legal ID. We are WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. And you're listening to 91.5 WMFO, Medford Tufts, freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And we are a show as part of that community base. We're called Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working-class, democratic socialist perspective. And we're on every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And in a minute, I'll read a public service announcement here because that's also part of what we need to do. But I have to find one first, and then after that we'll get into the $15 minimum wage thing. But I want to finish off with the British terrorist attacks. So getting back to the original point, despite what you may have heard, if you're new to left wing politics or socialist politics, these attacks are roundly condemned. As horrible, unnecessary, and just right wing really based attacks on working people, and so we oppose them obviously 100%, and we do have ways to oppose them on the ground, by the way, through organizing and so on. And speaking of that organizing, as I mentioned, the first targets of these types of groups, of these fundamentalist groups of whatever religion, but Islamic fundamentalism in this case, are target left wingers within their own countries before they get to the point where they can do a lot of damage outside the country, because the left stands in opposition to their methods and their worldview and et cetera. In Britain, there's also the factor of the elections. As I started to get into this, leader of the Labour Party, Corbyn, is a real left winger. The British Labour Party at this point, you can't characterize as completely left-wing or even what it was in the past when it was closer to its roots, early 20th century roots of being a social democratic party, a socialist party in essence. It's not that anymore, but it has elements of that still kicking around within it, and Corbyn is leading some of those people. And Corbyn, through talking about, if you look at the manifesto Labour's put out, I consider it rather weak, but it's just because it's not austerity, it's actually going to improve certain things. And promises to improve things and to renationalize the railroad system, to defend the healthcare system and so on, because it's not an austerity laden manifesto or proposal, which is what you'll get if May, the current Tory, current conservative prime minister, was not elected, by the way, is in power. That's what the Tories, that's not what they're saying they're going to do, but that's what they will do. They will bring about more austerity and more attacks on working class people and working class people's living standards in various ways. So there's some excitement, as you can imagine, among people in Britain. Latest polling data has, among working people in Britain, for Corbyn, latest polling data has Labour slightly ahead of the Tories, of the Conservatives, of May. That's her name, Theresa May, I guess is her name. And yet, two terrorist attacks within a few weeks. It's hard to say how that would play out in people's consciousness, but generally the corporate media puts forward the idea that it will, and I think there's a grain of truth in this, will turn people more into like wanting so-called tougher actions against the terrorists, and they think the conservatives would do that more. Now, I think that whole narrative is wrong. I think the fact that there's been these terrorist attacks continuing under a conservative regime shows that conservatives don't have any answers for stopping them. I'm not sure Corbyn does either, but I would take my chances more under Corbyn than I would under May that something could be, some sort of movement could be developed. Corbyn will certainly be more hospitable, most likely, and get the Labour Party to be more hospitable to movements, grassroots movements based on the left, based on unions and so on, to fight Islamic terror, fundamentalist Islamic terror, right-wing reactionary Islamic terror. On the other hand, because of these terrorist attacks still continuing, perhaps it won't have the effect of propelling May back into power. She's only been in a short time in these elections, but the terrorist attacks, and this is part of the whole, this is what part of what breaks down the whole idea of the terror, that there's some sort of relation between terrorism and the left. There is not. There's more relation between terrorism and the right, actually. And the terrorists, like in ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so on, they actually prefer the right-wing regimes in capitalist countries, in the advanced capitalist countries, the industrialized countries, to the liberal regimes. And they time these terrorist attacks often to influence elections. And they would prefer government in a place like Britain or the United States or France or Germany or whatever that would alienate further Muslim people within those countries. And that's what the conservatives tend to do. Certainly Trump has done that here, for example. So there's this weird symbiosis between, not so weird if you get down into that they're both capitalist and so on. There's a symbiosis between the right-wing fundamentalist regimes and terrorist groups and the conservative regimes that might, on the surface, be saying, you know, what is Trump's rhetoric? Trump's rhetoric is like, you know, against ISIS is so, based on exhortations of nationalism, implicit sort of Christian religious stuff as well. And yet ISIS and Trump have a lot more in common than it would seem at first glance in terms of their underlying philosophies, in terms of their what they want to see happen in the elections. I'm not saying it's any sort of organized relationship. I'm just saying that they have the enemy of my enemy type thing going on, and the enemy of my enemy, the enemy is the left, basically, around the world. And also just average working people, when you get down to it, that's an enemy for Trump and his administration. They want to use working people at best. The ones they can't use, they want to throw away. They want to starve in the streets, basically. And, well, this election is important in Britain because there's been elections recently where the right threatened to win. The French election ended up with a right winger. I mean, people call him a centrist or even a liberal, but he's really right winger, conservative, Macron, however you want to say it. American pronunciation, Macron. Macron's in power. Macron. You want to say it in French, it's Macron. And this guy's going to be, I saw a headline in an alternative website, Macron will be a lot like Thatcher. I completely agree. It's going to be that way. But the thing is, in France, people are going to fight, most likely fight hard against Macron. They've already started. And so he might not get away with what Thatcher got away with. Not that people in Britain didn't fight Thatcher. They certainly did, including members of the Socialist Party in Britain and so on. Now, we're going to talk about 15 now, as we mentioned. We kind of run out of time quickly here. But first, we'll talk about a health. So we'll talk about the a public service announcement. Sorry, numbers to think about. Public service announcement. U.S. healthcare concentration of healthcare spending in the U.S. population in 2009. Some healthcare numbers to think about. 1% of the U.S. population accounts for 22% of healthcare spending, and the top 5% accounts for 50%. Analyzed from a slightly different perspective, if Americans are divided into two groups, the healthier half uses just 3% of all medical care dollars, while the less healthy half accounts for 97% of all U.S. healthcare. That's actually a really rotten PSA, because that Of course, why not? Why wouldn't the sick account for most of the healthcare costs? I thought that was going to be a progressive PSA. It turned out to be a stupid PSA. Excuse me. All right. Now, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we're on the verge of victory for the fight for 15. And that is the fight. There's a grouping called the Fight for 15, mainly funded by SEIU, a union, Service Employees International Union. That's not been the case in Minneapolis or in Seattle, where a group called 15 Now took the lead. I mean, I think Fight for 15 exists in those places, but for a variety of reasons in Seattle, having to do with a socialist alternative member Sean Maswant getting elected and partially on the fighting for 15, that became a campaign that socialist alternative initiated a group called 15 Now. That means $15 minimum wage now. And that did end up passing in Seattle. That is law now in Seattle. And tens of thousands of workers, maybe hundreds of thousands, have benefited from that. Although it did end up with some phase-ins that we opposed that made it longer to happen than we wanted. So that still the law is still unfolding there for some workers. In Minneapolis and in other cities, Fight for 15 has led the way, and there have been gains made. A bunch of cities embracing $15 minimum wage. Some had it reversed in various ways. Unfortunately, two states have signed on to $15 minimum wage laws: California and New York. I'm not familiar with the exemptions to those laws. I bet there are some, or their phase-in periods. I'll get back on that. But that is relatively speaking, a step forward. And so now we have the situation in Minneapolis, and I'll just quote an article a bit here from Ty Moore, who's in Socialist Alternative. This is from the website socialistalternative.org. Minneapolis is poised to be the first Midwestern city to pass a $15 minimum wage. Following a three-year campaign initiated by Socialist Alternative and 15 Now, and embraced by the wider labor and progressive movement, the Minneapolis City Council on Friday, and this article is from May 27th, and there's been a big news since then, which I'll get into. On Friday, unanimously passed a staff directive to draw up an ordinance, that means a law, for $15 minimum wage, and scheduled a final vote for June 30th, and I imagine that means 2017, although that's not explicitly stated. So that's coming up soon. That'll be a vote in the City Council of Minneapolis, and it looks like it's going to be for 15. Now, I'll sort of get into shorthand here, and then maybe get back into the article a little bit, that basically you had a situation where Socialist Alternative with others initiated, through 15 Now and others initiated, a fight for 15 about two years ago, maybe 3 years. Three years. And, you know, it focused on airport workers, it focused on workers in general, and it gained momentum, and it got enough signatures. Huge task, but we got enough signatures to put it on the ballot in Minneapolis last fall for the presidential elections, November presidential elections. So you had this huge signature gathering thing, you had the huge grassroots campaign, and then you had the interesting thing happen where Ginger Jensen and Socialist Alternative, she's a member of Socialist Alternative, we announced a candidacy for a ward in Minneapolis, and that was going to be a big part of running, was to fight for 15. And Ginger was the executive director of 15 Now. She had been a food worker. I'm not sure if it was fast food or whatever, but it was food worker. And so momentum is gathering. The thing is polling at like 60% or more. I mean, brilliant polling numbers. By the time of the referendum, was approaching in November, and then all of a sudden, and I'll probably read a quote about this, before the referendum got, it was actually, I believe, they actually had them printed up, and it was actually out there, it at the last minute got yanked, because all but two Democrats, it's a totally Democratic Party city council, I believe, in Minneapolis, all but two of the Democrats were against the $15 minimum wage. And they hooked up with some conservative Republican judges and got the whole thing yanked off the referendum by dubious means. Now, what happened since then is Ginger Jensen campaign for Socialist Alternative fighting. The other groups still raising the issue in Minneapolis. And gains by the $15, by Fight for 15 and 15 Now in other cities, to all to the point where now the situation has changed. And this is a really important political lesson. The situation has changed through the mass pressure through the polling data reflecting that, still very high. Most of the Democrats have now said they are in favor of 15. Now, I'm not saying that in defense of the Democratic Party, because if you listen to the show, you know we don't support the Democratic Party. But what I'm saying is that they were forced to support 15. They really didn't want to. And that's as recently as a year ago. But the movement forced them to do this. Now they're going to try to take credit for it, by the way, and disappear 15 Now, disappear Socialist Alternative and all the other groups that supported it. But we're still in there fighting because we want a we're serious about 15 Now. We want it now. We don't want 15 with phase-ins until 2010 or something, you know, some ridiculous thing like that. I'm sorry, 2030 or something ridiculous like that. We want 15 Now, and we're going to fight for a good 15 Now bill, now that the whole idea of a $50 minimum wage has finally crossed the Rubicon, as they say. So a couple more quotes from Time Moore's article here from May 27th, socialalternative.org. On the verge of victory, how $15 an hour was won in Minneapolis. If it passes in this June 30th vote, the victory will provide a major boost to the city council election campaign of Ginger Jensen, J-E-N-T-Z-E-N, Socialist Alternative member and former executive director of 15 Now, and a driving force behind the $50 fight in Minneapolis. In a crucial win for workers, the ordinance, again, that's law, does not, the one that's being proposed right now, does not include a lower minimum wage for tipped workers. That means some of the 15-hour minimum wage laws have unfortunately parceled out waiters and waitresses, you know, tipped workers, even beyond waiters and waitresses, I believe, and said, oh, because they get tips, they don't get the $15 an hour. And anyone that's been a tip worker knows, come on, the way that that crap averages out, unless you're really lucky, is you're always losing that, and you need the $15 an hour. And in some states, I think all states, or maybe federally, let me just, not the states that have passed 15, perhaps, but I'll double check that. You have these ridiculous laws that allow a lower minimum wage for food service, for restaurant workers, and so on. It's just absurd, you know. And there's a whole, group now, ROC, R-O-C, Restaurant Organizing Committee, or something like that, that fights this stuff as well, along with 15, Fight for 15 and 15 Now. Anyway, while momentum is now clearly on the side of workers to win 15, there remains a real risk of business escalating pressure in the weeks ahead, because June 30th is coming up fast, to secure more carve-outs. That's the idea of carving out portions of workers. Or even a longer phase-in. Phase-in means when does the law totally take effect for everyone. The biggest mistake the 15 movement could make right now would be to sit back and celebrate a premature victory. The movement must stay vigilant and continue escalating the pressure for the strongest possible ordinance law until the final vote is taken. Despite the long phase-in, which I guess already exists, and other concessions, this minimum wage ordinance, if passed, would represent possibly the biggest victory for the left and labor movement in the Twin Cities in decades. In an era of rising inequality, a $15 minimum wage would raise wages for 71,000 Minneapolis workers, and according to a new study, will put an estimated $140 million a year into the pockets of workers. Has any other city policy resulted in such a large transfer of wealth from big business to workers in Minneapolis history? Especially for women and workers of color who remain concentrated in low-wage jobs, a victory for 15 will represent a major step forward, providing a big boost to the fight, the wider fight against Minnesota's worst in the nation racial inequities. If Minneapolis becomes the first major non-coastal city to pass $15 an hour, it will open the doors to victories across the Midwest, which has been decimated by the economic crisis. In 3 short years, the fight for 15 in Minneapolis went from an isolated call from the far left, that's self-referential, I guess, to us, the far left, to become the central slogan of the Minneapolis labor and progressive movement in the 2017 city elections. Socialist Alternative was the first to popularize the demand for $15 an hour in Minneapolis through our mass door knocking for our 2013 city council campaign in Ward 9, which came within 229 votes of winning. This is a huge victory for many of us who have been working for this for years, said a city council member who was one of the two who came out for it. And it's no secret, even this Democrat admits, that the movement started in Ward 9 with people like Ty Moore and Ginger Jensen and CTUL leader Veronica Mendez Moore. Also in November 2013, Shama Sawant won her first city council race in Seattle by pioneering the popular call for $15 minimum wage there. And within 6 months of winning her seat, Seattle became the first major city to pass $15. Seattle's wage hike was a historic victory, and combined with the inspiring wave of fast food worker strikes over the previous year, that means the Fight for 15 grouping, helped spark a far wider movement 15 across the country. So, yeah, he, and then the article goes into how the Democrats changed their stripes on this, which is good, but again, watch out. You know, it's fraught with danger. For example, in relying on the Democrats is not the way to go, because, like, for example, in Maryland recently, two very powerful Democrats, the mayor of Baltimore and the something or other supervisor, I guess it was called, or something, of Montgomery County, they both, after promising to support 15, they both vetoed 15 legislation that made it through the city council in Baltimore and this rich county in Maryland for this other person. We talked about that on the previous show. So then he goes into how the Democratic Party opposed the ballot initiative for 15 and the coalition that had initiated it, led by Social Alternative. In a fractious public battle, only council members Cam Gordon and Alejandro Cano stood up to business and political pressure, hiding behind dubious legal objections. The city council voted 11-2 to block the 15 initiative from going to voters. That was just last year. In August of 15 now, an NOC took the city of Minneapolis to court and won, with a judge ordering the charter amendment to be put to voters in November of last year. However, the city appealed. This is the Democrats. And the Minnesota Supreme Court, dominated by Republican appointees, overturned the lower court decision denying voters the opportunity to pass 15. So anybody out there that cares about workers, working people of all sorts, and anyone that cares about the future of youth in this country and so on, but then says that the Democratic Party let's say this popular thing propagated by the corporate media that, you know, we need bipartisanship. We need bipartisanship. It's horrible that politics is so partisan now. Well, in some ways it's partisan, but in some ways there's things that Democrats and Republicans tend to agree on, and that is screwing over workers. And we do not need bipartisanship in that situation. Don't be careful what you wish for. I would love to see the Democrats and Republicans fighting each other for keeping their living standards above ours and so on, Meanwhile, in the electoral realm and other realms, mass movements are built. Like, for example, in Seattle, because of Shama Sawant of Social Alternative being elected and reelected as open social alternative member, it created this huge kind of left situation. I don't say huge, but huge left kind of space for the left there, where now there are two progressive independents, one who says he's a democratic socialist, running for mayor, one running for city council in Seattle, in independents, so progressive or left independents running. So I'd rather see that kind of formation start to happen, process start to happen, than some sort of bipartisan consensus, which, as you can see in Minneapolis, resulted in a delay at best, and at worst shot down 15. But hopefully it will pass. It looks like it's going to pass. Interesting stuff. Social Alternative into the council elections with Ginger Jensen. Social Alternative member and former executive director of 15 now is Ginger Jensen, offering voters a taste of what a socialist organizer elected in a city hall could accomplish. Much like Shama Sawant's socialist campaigns in Seattle, Jensen's campaign is having a citywide impact by acting as a platform to provide a voice and a political lead for movement organizers. With Socialist Alternative as the core activist base, Jensen's campaign has won support from broader forces, including the unions, the Minnesota Nurses Association, and the Communication Workers of America. However, most unions and progressive forces remain tied to the Democratic Party, despite the entire experience of the 15 fight pointing to the need for independent left politics. Let's see. More on that. Chamber of Commerce doesn't like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No kidding. I'm glad he mentioned that. Over the last 4 years, workers and activists have pushed $15 an hour every step of the way, with most politicians chasing to catch up. That's an understatement. Now more than ever, we need to step up the pressure from below to win the strongest $15 possible. The rent won't wait, and neither should a living wage. That's, by the way, an interesting slogan that came out of the $15 campaign in Seattle. The rent won't wait. That's very, very true, unfortunately. Powerful grassroots upsurge that has nearly won $15 shows the potential to build an entirely new type of politics in Minneapolis. The momentum behind the Ginger Jensen's campaign in Ward 3 is rooted in the unapologetic demand that Minneapolis meet the needs of working people by radically changing its politics. from its politics as usual. So that's really good news. I'll just add to that a little bit. Again, if you're just tuning in, probably going to have a $15 minimum wage in Minneapolis, Minnesota by the end of the month. That remains to be seen fully, but the momentum is there for it, where even the Democrats, most of them have come along based on pressure of a mass movement there, 415. Let's see. There's going to be, there's a campaign that is reinforcing the need for 15 by Ginger Jensen, who's a member of Social Alternative, running as an open socialist, as a member of Social Alternative, and she was director of 15 Now, executive director of 15 Now, and before that, she was a fast food or food worker. Let's see. 15 Now in Minnesota is heating up, and there's right now 15 support for 15, even among some of the Democrats, with no tip penalty, meaning no penalty against tip workers. They'll get the full 15. But the phase-ins aren't good. And plus, you have the Minnesota Restaurant Association has launched an aggressive campaign for a tip penalty. And there are rumors that the commissions, they're commissioning negative polling, negative messaging polls, and prepared to spend hundreds of thousands to win tip penalty. So what we want in Social Alternative and the Ginger Jensen campaign is to be seen is to fight for the strongest possible 15. And this would be, again, the first victory of $50 off the coast, led by socialists 3 years after the historic victory in Seattle. So that's overall good news. Now, what's the bad news in the fight for 15? And unfortunately, there is some. It's a fancy word called preemption. Preemption bills are happening in many states, especially down south. Preemption bills is a fancy term for states that screw over workers by saying no municipality, saying in a law, no municipality or city or town can pass its own minimum wage laws. And of course, you might ask, why not? You know, and there is no good reason why not. There is just the conservatives, including Democrats, in many states pressing this. So, for example, Massachusetts has a law like that. Now, they're not calling it a preemption thing because it's been on the books for a while, but we can't organize, and we desperately want to organize, fight for 15 or 15 Now in places like Worcester and Springfield and Boston, of course, and everywhere else, you know. And instead, you have to do it statewide, which is really, really difficult. And then you have, Rhode Island has the same thing. You can only do it statewide. And I don't have a figure here of how many states have that kind of rotten bill, but the ones that didn't. And even where, like in Alabama, they want to increase the minimum wage, there's a huge thing, including, this happened in Missouri, Arizona, Texas, and Alabama, preemption bills to, again, roll back or prevent in the future any local, meaning city or town or whatever, minimum increase in the minimum wage. And this is really horrible, but it's happening. And it's been going on for a while, unfortunately. And again, it shows the need for a new party, because where the Democrats rule, like in Massachusetts, they're perfectly comfortable with this. Yeah, oh yeah, it has to be statewide. Screw you. You know, now they just had their convention in Worcester yesterday, the Democratic Party in Massachusetts. And I heard a soundbite, and the guy, they've tacked to the left, you know, in terms of populism. And they're like, yeah, family leave. Didn't say how much. Then 15 Now, or they don't say 15 Now, they say $50 minimum wage. Okay, that sounds great. And if we can push them, like in Minneapolis, to do that, that's a step forward. But that bill has also been sitting in the state legislature for a long time here in Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, all Democrats, they could have passed it whenever it got in, they could have passed it immediately. So the question is, how much longer are they going to let it languish? The question is, how much, what's in it? I don't have all the details, but if they follow their form, the Democratic Party likes long phase-ins, meaning that, you know, push this over into 2020, 2021, whatever, and it won't, and they're correct, unfortunately, in this, it won't help as much. They don't say that publicly, but that's really what they're getting at. Oh, don't worry, businesses, we got your back, corporations, big corporations, you know, because by 2022, inflation will have made this $15 minimum wage equivalent to the crap that exists now for a minimum wage around the country and in some states. Now, small businesses, like in Seattle, we dealt with this, could get a subsidy if they really, really can't afford a $50 minimum wage. Most really can, even if they cry, they can't. And big businesses certainly can afford it. And also, there's a lot of empirical data from places where, like Seattle, where 15 has happened, and it's had the exact opposite effect on the economy than was predicted, rather than create a problem in the restaurant industry or beyond. It's actually helped the restaurant industry, helped the economy, because it puts more money in workers' pockets. Now, there are other things happening in the economy that eventually, like inflation, that will probably get rid of that increase, but get rid of that effect, but it won't be because of adopting $15 minimum wage. It will be in spite of it, unfortunately. So now we have people talking about, well, 15 is too low, and it's always been too low. Social Alternative never claimed 15 was a living wage, but it is a step in the right direction. And after a certain point, after, believe me, some arguing with some really thick-headed people, it became more popular. And it's hard to find people that are against it now. They're there. They're out there. They swallow some working people, even some, you know, activists. Well, actually, I don't know about activists, but I've definitely read, like, random stuff on Facebook that probably came from a working person who starts mimicking the arguments of the bosses. Like, well, if you have 15... then you have to, you know, this will cause small businesses to go out of business. And, well, no, it won't, actually. They make more money than you think. They can get subsidized if necessary. You could create a law like that to help. Basically, they can afford it, actually. Then the other argument is, well, okay, so you get 15, then it's going to lead to higher unemployment, because even the big businesses in general, they usually don't make the distinction. I don't know why I'm making it for them. We make that distinction. They don't. Oftentimes, businesses will not be able to afford to hire as many workers. Again, empirical evidence, studies show that's not the case. It depends on what's going on in the market in general, separate from the minimum wage increases. So, for example, you increase the minimum wage to 15, increase to 20, which is really what we should be talking about now. Increase to 20 an hour, and then see what happens. With the effect it has in the economy, it could have, and this is what's happened with other minimum wage increases, no matter how large, it could have a really positive effect, where the capitalists are getting less profit, but they're still getting profit. So what's the big deal? Now, for the capitalists, that's a huge deal. They never want us to take an inch step backward in terms of their rate of profit, in terms of their aggregate profits. But for working people, for society, screw you. You do not need to always be maximizing your profits in the short term. You do not need that. You can survive, unfortunately, but you can survive with taking less profit. And they'd have to do that for other costs anyway. It's just labor is one they can really mess with and really depress and force down, basically through terror on workers. But that, you know, through the, you know, workers' wages are variable compared to some fixed cost businesses have, like depreciation on machinery, rent, and so on, that they have to pay and don't have much control over in some circumstances. And yet wages, they can really mess with. They can mess with our heads at work. They can force fewer people to do more work, etc. But also, if the economy is expanding, right, and they want to gain market share, which they often want to do, anticipating a growth actually in profits, they will do that even with a minimum wage increase, and find that since the pie sort of has grown, the economy, if you want to use a pie analogy, which people often do, the pie has grown, they're going to get more of that growth even with a $20 minimum wage or $15 minimum wage. And that's just the facts. That's what happens. So they end up not losing rate of profit. They don't end up losing aggregate profit. And they're in there gaining more market share, hiring more people. So there's no empirical evidence that minimum wage increases result in less hiring by the bosses. It's actually not true. The opposite is true. Now, in inflation, sometimes people will trot out an inflation argument, say, oh, you raise wages, you increase inflation. Well, the reality is that, no, people have studied this, and and the increases in wages are trying to keep up with inflation that's already out there. Inflation does not come from wage increases. Inflation comes from the money, the circulation of currencies, of money, and the amounts of money, you know, in comparison to goods and services created in an economy. And when things become more expensive, right, because of, you know, credit rules, how much money is allowed to circulate, because of things like in one sector of the economy, something happened and got, and it maybe was a crucial thing like oil, and that's involved in so many productive processes and so on, and involved in, you know, running of cars and all that, that it creates a ripple effect of inflation throughout the economy. There's a lot of triggering mechanisms, but basically it's that divorce of amount of money equaling goods and services produced. If there's a lot more money out there, then that leads to inflation, the currency being worth less, even though there's more of it out there. And it doesn't, it's not scientific when that moment is reached. It's sort of empirically seen in hindsight, you know, like the economic statistics are not in real time. They're usually a month or two old or older, depending on how often they decide to keep them. They being the government, the capitalist-run governments, and so you end up. That was a pretty big spike in inflation back then, and there's no hint of workers getting any sort of decent increases during that time. Then later, workers try where they can through unions, through popular pressure, and so on, to get some sort of wage increases, cost of living adjustments for things like Social Security or whatever, and usually not succeeding in recent times. And if they do succeed, you can't blame that on the inflation that already started, that already got going. Last but not least, the books I promised that we would talk about briefly. Books, The Color of Law. This is a new book by Richard Rothstein, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. So at a time when there's racist attacks on the increase, it seems, due to Trump being in power and emboldening, right-wing white supremacist groups and so on, at a time when the continued shootings of black youth and others by the police, the police repression continues in the country with the most people in prison in the world, including rate of imprisonment and aggregate number of prisoners, which means it's not the freest country in the world, by the way, not even close. This is an outrage. The mass incarceration continues. You had Trump's attorney general or whatever they call him, Jeffords, ordering longer sentences. In other words, pushing for the same policies that Clinton and Obama and now Clinton, Bush and Obama and now Trump want to push of continuing mass incarceration. That hits people of color the hardest, obviously, especially black youth, and this is just horrible, you know, conditions and racism out there, and the response. What's the best response? Illusions in identity politics versus people that are really trying to get at the institutional causes of racism, and how capitalism is an institutional cause itself. An economic systemic cause and one that makes worse all the institutional causes and even psychological causes and so on, or psychological responses to the causes and so on. Like, and the reason I found this book interesting, based on an interview I heard, is that I could see with the current climate of in some circles the popularity of identity politics, a whole sort of so-called analysis of segregation, housing segregation in America, which is horrible and rampant, either embracing segregation, that's part of where identity politics can lead to in some cases, in some interpretations of it, can lead to embracing segregation, actually, as a good thing. I don't think it is. I think if we're going to survive as a human species, that multiracial struggle is absolutely necessary. That's the way the workers' movement has always been built. and when it's really gone forward, and that's, of course, what the socialist movement is built on, inequality. Of the goal is equality. The goal, and to get there, is obviously multiracial struggle, solidarity, and also just in terms of freedom, real freedom. People should be able to choose their relationships and where they live and so on. So segregation that mandates economically and in other ways, and what this book gets into legally, the emergence of legal and economic segregation in America is a crime. It's a crime against humanity. And anyone that would defend that in any way, either from a right-wing perspective or a perspective that claims to be some sort of progressive perspective, which just says it's all a psychological thing of white flight or segregation is good or something weird like that. This guy just basically calmly says, well, look, you know, this is some really horrible stuff that happened, not out of accident, not out of innate racism, not out of white flight, although, you know, there's certainly racism and there's certainly some white flight. But overall, mostly, it can be proven that the federal government, dominated by the capitalists, that's what I'll put in there. I don't know if he dares to go that far, but dominated by the capitalists, obviously, did what the title, the subtitle says, Government Segregated America. Again, The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. And again, I haven't read the whole thing, but so far what I've read, I've liked. The book starts off with a picture, interesting picture of Roosevelt, FDR, the liberal icon, giving out the keys to a house to the 100,000th family to receive lodging in the federal government's public housing program, 1940, pretty late. But here's the caveat. Most projects were for whites only, which Roosevelt went along with. So just a little quick things to introduce this book. Again, if you want to read it, please do. The Color of Law, Forgotten History of Our Government Segregated, How Our Government Segregated America by Richard Rothstein. And I say please read it because it looks like it's going to be good from the beginning. Wish I'd gotten further. Okay, so here we go. De facto segregation, we tell ourselves, has various causes. When African Americans moved into neighborhoods, a neighborhood like Ferguson, a few racially prejudiced white families decided to leave. And then, as the number of black families grew, the neighborhood deteriorated and, quote, white flight, unquote, followed. Real estate agents steered whites away from black neighborhoods and blacks away from white neighborhoods. Banks discriminated with redlining, refusing to give mortgages to African Americans or extracting unusually severe terms from them with subprime loans. African Americans haven't generally gotten the educations that would enable them to earn sufficient incomes to live in white suburbs, and as a result, many remain concentrated in urban neighborhoods. Besides, black families prefer to live with one another. So these are all arguments that claim, singularly often, to explain segregation in America in terms of housing in America. Now, by the way, redlining is a real thing, and I hope he's not downplaying that. I will see. Anyway, so he says all of this has some truth, but it remains a small part of the truth. I would argue redlining was not a small part of the truth, but anyway. Submerged by a far more important one, until the last quarter of the 20th century, racially explicit policies of federal, state, and local governments defined where whites and African Americans should live. Today, residential segregation in the North, South, Midwest, and West is not the unintended consequence of individual choices and of otherwise well-meaning law or regulation, but instead of unhidden public policy that explicitly segregated every metropolitan area in the United States. The policy was so systemic and forceful that its effects endure to the present time. Without our government's purposeful imposition of racial segregation, the other causes, private prejudice, white flight, real estate, steering, bank redlining, income differences, and self-segregation still would have existed, but with far less opportunity for expression. Well, if he puts redlining in that case, like the government could have stopped it, I would agree, but it was still a huge factor. Anyway, that's something we'll get to reading the book more. In the future, hopefully, segregation by intentional government actions is not de facto. Rather, it is what courts call de jure, segregation by law and public policy. And then he goes into the history. I don't have time to read all that. but just another introduction to the book as a whole. The Color of Law, the title of this book, is concerned with the consistent government policy that was employed in the mid-20th century to enforce residential racial segregation. There were many specific government actions that prevented African Americans and whites from living among one another, and I categorized them as unconstitutional. In doing so, I reject the widespread view that an action is not unconstitutional until the Supreme Court says so. Few Americans think that racial segregation in schools was constitutional before 1954 when the Supreme Court prohibited it. Rather, segregation was always unconstitutional, although a misguided Supreme Court majority mistakenly failed to recognize this. Yet even if we came to a nationally shared recognition that government policy has created an unconstitutional de jure system of residential segregation, it does not follow that litigation can remedy the situation, etc. And then as a part, I was going to read, but just really don't have time. So I really, you know, so far am seeing things here that are worth getting into. He gets into the Federal Housing Administration. So, for example, statistical evidence contradicted the FHA's assumption that the presence of African Americans caused the property values of whites to fall. Often racial integration caused property values to increase, ironically. With government policy excluding working and middle class African Americans from most suburbs, their desire to escape dense urban conditions spurred their demand for single family or duplex homes on the outskirts of urban ghettos nationwide. Because these middle class families had few other housing alternatives and were willing to pay prices far above fair market values. In short, the FHA policy of denying African Americans access to most neighborhoods itself created conditions that prevented property values from falling when African Americans did appear. And by the way, screwed over African Americans terribly with the inflated housing prices, which is still happening. And he actually goes into that, into ways that happened. And this phenomenon called block busting. He does get into redlining some more. So anyway, this is a book really worth checking out. And we'll talk more about it in future shows. Also, the 100 Years That Shook the World, A New History of the Russian Revolution by China Mieville, I don't know how people are pronouncing his name. And it's called October by China Mieville, The Story of the Russian Revolution. And Ron Jacobs wrote a good review of this April 27th, 2017 in Counterpunch. I'll just quickly... it's a story of 1917 in revolutionary Russia. The three-volume set written by the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky is probably the most complete and certainly the most inspiring of all of the histories of the Russian Revolution. And also it goes without saying that the revolution itself has been disparaged by the capitalists and their cheerleaders ever since the first moment in February 1917 when the Soviets, these are mass workers' councils of mass councils of workers and peasants and so on, took over Petrograd. Even more damaging than the aspersions of the capitalist media, though, was the counter-revolution launched against the revolutionary government and the subsequent machinations of that government, which caused its mutation and ultimate dissolution. He says barely 8 years later. I would say that's 1925, 26, 27. As I noted above, this just-published New History of the Russian Revolution by China Mieville is, et cetera. I'm going to skip some of the hyperbole here. Although I think it's true, I shouldn't say hyperbole, some of the, since it's fast-paced and so on, actions from the front, etc. What I really want to get to was he compares it to another book very worth reading. We mentioned it on the show before, John Reed's 10 Days That Shook the World. So the reviewer says, it's as if John Reed, the author of the classic piece of revolutionary journalism, 10 Days That Shook the World, woke from a decades-long sleep to tell the story of 1917 once again. And, although there is less personal detail, the sweep of Mieville's story is equal to Reed's in its breadth while matching its passion. It's Reed's contention, going back to 10 Days of the World, that the masses of workers, peasants, and soldiers were at the front of the revolution. And now 100 years later, Mieville agrees. So that looks really worth reading. I have not started to read that yet, except for little excerpts online. And then there's a book called White Trash, The 40-Year Untold History of Class in America by Nancy Eisenberg. This is, again, I think this year or late last year came out, late last year. I've started to read it a couple times. I haven't got too far, but some of the stuff I'm reading is pretty good. Really good, actually. Let's see. The reality on the ground in terms of social mobility in America. Is what she gets into right from the start. And let's see. true purpose of this book, she says, is I want to make the point unambiguously by reevaluating the American historical experience in class terms. I expose what is too often ignored about American identity, but I'm not just pointing out what we've gotten wrong about the past. I also want to make it possible to better appreciate the gnawing contradictions still present in modern American society. So that's a useful goal, very interesting goal, obviously. Then very quickly, in a chapter called Fables We Forget By, she really destroys, reminiscently of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, some of the cherished myths. So here we go. Instead, so pilgrims, supposedly, people who are celebrated at Thanksgiving, a holiday that did not exist until the Civil War. So Thanksgiving did not exist until the Civil War. Who came ashore at Plymouth Rock, a place only designated as such in the late 18th century. The quintessential American holiday was associated with a native turkey to help promote the struggling poultry industry during the Civil War. The word pilgrim was not even popularized until 1794. Nevertheless, the quote-unquote first Thanksgiving has been given a date of 1621, when well-meaning pilgrims and fair-minded Wampanoags shared a meal. Excuse me. The master of ceremonies was their Indian interpreter, Squanto, who had helped the English survive a difficult winter. Left out of all this story is the detail, not so minor, that Squanto only knew English because he had been kidnapped and sold as a slave to an English ship's captain. Coerced labor of this kind, excuse me, reminds us of how the majority of white servants came to America. Squanto's friendship, alas, was a far more complicated affair than the fairy tale suggests. He died of a mysterious fever the very next year, while engaged in a power struggle with Massasoit, the great sachem of the Wampanoags Confederation. Excuse me. Couple other quick quotes to get you interested maybe in reading this book. White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America by Nancy Eisenberg. Moving on to the first settlements, colonization settlements in the U.S., they're given a pretty picture that she says is whitewashed. Though New World settlers were supposed to represent the promise of social mobility and the pilgrims generated our hallowed faith in liberty, 19th century Americans paradoxically created a larger-than-life cast of, quote, democratic, unquote, royalty. These inheritors founded the first genealogical societies in the 1840s. By the turn of the 20th century, patriotic organizations with emphasis on heredity, descent, and such were founded, such as the General Society of the Mayflower Descendants and Order of the Founders of the Patriots of America, boasted chapters across the nation. The highly inclusive Order of the First Families of Virginia was established in 1912, its members claiming that their lineage could be traced back to the English lords and Lady Rebecca Rolfe, whom we all know as the noble and anglicized Pocahontas. She also goes on to talk about that myth. She says the colonists, these are early colonists, the earliest ones, were a mixed lot. On the bottom of the heap were men and women of the poor and criminal classes. Among these unheroic transplants were roguish highwaymen, mean vagrants, Irish rebels, known whores, and an assortment of convicts shipped to the colonies for grand larceny or other property crimes as a reprieve of sorts to escape the gallows, meaning being hung. Not much better were those who filled the ranks of indentured servants, ranged in class position from lowly street urchins to former artisans burdened with overwhelming debts. They had taken a chance in the colonies, having been impressed into service, that means forced into service, and then choosing exile over possible incarceration within the walls of an overcrowded, disease-ridden English prison. Labor shortages led some ship's captains and agents to round up children from the streets of London and other towns to sell to planters across the ocean. This was known as spiriting, quote unquote. Young children were shipped off for petty crimes. I don't have time to get into the, she gives an example. So this is a book called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America by Nancy Eisenberg. You might want to check that out. I will persevere in finding time to read despite the horrible work schedule and the commute and everything else and raising the family and all that. What we didn't have time to get into in detail, which I'll just have to mention sort of in headline form, is the AT&T worker strike that happened at the end of May, 3-day strike. Now, this was pretty important. It's the biggest strike in the first major strike of the Trump era, number one. And it also follows from last year's pretty successful strike by CWA members at Verizon. And it affected a lot of workers, 17,000 let's see, who provide phone, cable, and landline services in California and Nevada, as well as 21,000 members employed by AT&T Mobility, most of them either in retail sales or call center workers with no previous experience of going on strike. Now, that point is important. Now, what happened in New England around in cities like Boston, Providence, and so on, is the stores. So, you know, the different phone stores selling smartphones and all that. So AT&T has, I think I read somewhere, 30% of that market or something. So they have their stores around. And the workers, the retail workers in these stores went out on strike for 3 days. That's very, very impressive. And they've got some very important demands related to wages, health care, and so on. For example, the main demands of the mobile units include a pay raise to cover increased health care costs, a higher base pay, and or a fixed rate of commissions for retail sales for workers, no increase in health contributions in 2021, and an end to a two-tier plan that puts health care beyond the reach of new employees who are not covered at all for the first 6 months of employment. Equally importantly, contract demands call for job security language against contracting out the retail stores to subcontractors whose employees have no union representation, against outsourcing work to outside contractors and call centers, to countries where employees have no union rights. CWA is demanding that outsourcing be reversed, creating more union jobs. Now, outsourcing, sending jobs to a company in the United States or often outside the United States that does the same work the workers there are doing, but does it probably cheaper because there's probably no union. That's the whole engine behind outsourcing. And that's, you know, predicated upon increases in technology in terms of transportation and communications, but there's no sort of truly objective reason for it. It is a choice companies make, and they'll still make a profit with the workers that they one day were not outsourced, the next day were. They'll still make a profit with the non-outsourced workforce. Now, outsourcing is huge. Probably some people listening are, it's happening where they work. I work at Harvard University, one of the largest employers in Massachusetts, maybe the first, second, or third largest. I've read different statistics. They're doing outsourcing. I work in a library system. They're doing outsourcing of library work to non-union companies that that, you know, sell their low rent services, you know, so to speak, with no health care and no union and so on, to say, yeah, we'll do all this stuff cheaper. They do it worse, whatever. They'll do it cheaper. They'll do it worse. Just get it out of the way, you know. And the powers that be at Harvard, the corporate board at Harvard, sees no future for libraries. But it's not just libraries. They've outsourced pension funds. They've outsourced accounting and you know, servicing. They outsource whatever they can, basically. And you really wonder sometimes if it even is saving them any money or it's just a form of union busting. My union refuses to acknowledge that it could be union busting, but that's there. And I think that's the long-term plan because, you know, I don't think they really save money off of some of the outsourcing, but some of it they definitely do because they're going to places that are non-union. And in this article, which I don't have time to go more into, it's May 31st by Steve Edwards, socialistalternative.org, under Workers Movement. One of the outsourced things from AT&T went to the Dominican Republic. The workers there promptly tried to organize and got totally terrorized by the government and by the company. So, we have very few union rights in the United States. Other countries have less. And the big corporations like AT&T try to take advantage of that. So we're pretty much out of time. We're going to go out with, I don't know what song I put in there. Let's see. Let's go out with this song. Magnificent Seven by The Clash. Yes, The Clash again, if you're a regular listener. Enjoy. And thank you for listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. Again, we're here every other Sunday, Alternative Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we are here to provide talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. We hope you enjoy the show. To contact us on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio. Contact Socialist Alternative at socialistalternative.org. And there's a new issue of Socialist Alternative's newspaper out. Go to socialistalternative.org, try to get you a copy. Try to subscribe to a copy or to a bunch of, to a year subscription, whatever. And you'll enjoy it, I think. Because right now we need, obviously, as always, someone somewhere, some media standing up for working people and youth. And that's what we're about. So keep up the struggle. Go to the Pride demonstrations coming up. Go to the anti-Trump things that are inevitably going to come up. and we'll see you there at those rallies, at those picket lines, and so on. And support the AT&T workers. They'll probably have to go on strike again. I'm not sure about that. And we'll go out with some music. And again, thanks for listening. You are listening to WMFO in Medford.